a colleague, a mentor, a partner, a husband, and a neighbor. I knew him as my father, a fearless, passionate, generous man with a sharp and sometimes sardonic sense of humor and a shy grace. I wanted to share just two quick memories. When I was about Luke's age, he and I took a walk in the woods behind our house. I loved walking in the woods with him and with my mom. It was evening and it was dark and we were holding hands. My dad asked me if I was afraid of the dark. I don't remember what I said. I remember my dad's grown-up hand holding my child's hand. And I remember my dad's words. He said, "Never be afraid of anything." That's how he lived. As many of you know, he loved the constant competitive challenge of his work. He loved going to auditions. He loved to fly his airplane in all weather. The more instrument flying required, the better. His fondest flying stories were of the two occasions when he pulled out of potentially fatal situations. I'm sure a lot of you have heard these. Once when his engine failed at night over Long Island Sound, and he glided his plane into a cornfield that he somehow spotted in the dark, and he just missed a rock quarry. And he braked because his engine wasn't working by catching his wing of his plane against the tree. It was at the New York Post. It was exciting. And once, much more recently, Pat was with him, and he was flying east over the Canadian Rockies, and his wings iced up, and his plane started descending. When he got down to a lower elevation, he managed to shake the ice off the wings. Pat, who courageously accompanied him and managed to get back in the plane with him the next day, can provide all the details. As you can all imagine, my dad told me he was laughing on both these occasions. His courage and ability to laugh were two of his defining qualities. Another important event in my life with him: when Luke was 6 weeks old, my dad came out to Seattle to see his grandson for the first time. As my dad's dear friend, Dick Shepherd, told me a few weeks ago, my dad never believed he was going to have a grandchild. Luke was born when Darren and I were 45. It had been some 40 years since my dad had really held a baby, maybe longer. In fact, we have a picture in our house of my dad holding Luke at that age, and Luke said, "Why does Grandpa look embarrassed?" I told him that he needed to hold Luke, and I set him up with an old but clean diaper to protect his very nicely ironed shirt. My dad sat on our couch and held his baby grandson in his arms for half an hour. I watched his expression change from discomfort, embarrassment, and uncertainty to pure joy. That half hour changed our family life. Through our son Luke, my dad and I discovered a new grace between us. My dad faced mesothelioma with courage, grace, humor, and tranquility. No matter how ill he felt, he never complained. He always asked about the well-being of each of us who called him or visited him. When I saw him in the hospital the night before he died, the last thing he asked me was whether I had a comfortable place to stay. And I know Pat talked about, he was always asking about her well-being. She was with him every day in the hospital, 10 or 11 hours a day. Before he died. I'm so grateful for that. Were my dad here, he would rejoice in the love and friendship you've all showed him over his lifetime. He would want us to eat and drink and laugh and celebrate and walk away from this event remembering that every minute we have is precious. I'm very honored that you're all here, and I'd like to ask Mr. Charles Odgood to come up and speak. And in my nervousness, I said, Your name, Mr. Charles Osgood. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meg. Thank you for organizing this and for inviting us all here for what is really a celebration. And I think that that's what Joe would like, rather than a memorial or what these things are usually called. Joel Krager was more than just, I have to tell you that everybody in this business envied Joel's voice. That was something else. But he got into radio, I'm told, he first went on the radio when he was 8 years old. He cannot have had that voice when he was 8 years old. And did it fairly consistently from the time he was 11 years old. Radio just beckoned to him. He sensed, as I did too when I was a kid, that there was nothing more wonderful, nothing more adventurous, and nothing else that I could think of that I wanted to do except somehow be on the radio. And I know that Joel felt the same way. So what was it? If it was not his voice, then what was it about Joel that made him who he was and made him such a great friend and companion and colleague and all of neighbor or whatever, but friends in every case, because he made friends of just about everybody he met. Well, for one thing, Joel and Pat visited us at our place in France, and it was just a beautiful day. We enjoyed the company so much because I never met anyone who more lived up to the French word raconteur than Joel. I don't speak any French at all, but that word, when I think of it, I think they ought to put Joel's picture next to the in the dictionary next to the definition of. Because it was through that, the voice was a tremendous asset to have, along with his storytelling abilities. But everything that when he told a story, he just wrapped you up in it. And he liked to talk about things that had actually happened to him. So he was telling you about his life. And you had this sense of being let in on a marvelous adventure, which I know he thought his life was. And I know that almost everybody in this room has probably heard about Luke, because he liked to talk about Luke. It was one of his favorite subjects. And he talked about his flying, and he talked about his love of that. And I think the advice that he gave you, Meg, about not being afraid of anything, was something that he not only believed in some kind of abstract way, but he actually lived that way, and so therefore he was a great person to know. And I think his greatest gift is that he made you somehow feel as if maybe your own life was more interesting than you had realized until he had a chance to draw it out of you. And I think he brought out the best in the people that he met, and in the people that he loved, and I think that's why so many of us loved him. And the particulars about flying and about broadcasting and all of that, I never was a colleague of his in the sense that we worked at the same place and I would see him every day. But on those occasions when we did meet, I always felt as if I learned something about the business that I was in, and learned something about what it is to be, it's something you kind of take for granted after a time, if you go in and you do it every day. But he made it seem something very special, because he was such a very, very special person. And I know what he did for me, he probably did for almost all of you too, because you all know him as a friend. And I'm honored to have been invited to tell you about that this morning, and others will follow. Thank you very much. I'll see you on the radio.
Thank you all for coming. I'm Howard Gintel, one of Joel's nephews. Today we celebrate his story. And while each of us played a part, we have just been supporting players. Excuse me. So to paraphrase the sign outside the studio when they recorded We Are the World, please check your egos to the door, because this really is about Joel and the joys he brought us all. I long ago stopped paying much attention to the religion in which I was raised, but at heart I am a Jew, and my heritage of almost 6,000 years is real to me without the religious complications. In many ways, I think Joel felt the same way, and it is one reason why I'm delighted that this celebration is here at his beloved Friars Club, the home of his real religion, focused on joy and food and fun, and not in some other building that celebrates some other religion. But having said that, my heritage, on occasion, provided some insights. Jews recently celebrated the New Year, and I thought back to another year. The Jewish year 5757 began just 2 months after my mother's death in July 1996. Joel was her baby brother. That year, the Kol Nidre service for me was more important and more poignant rather than at any other time in my life. For the first time, I had no parent to wish a happy year, and this year, I had no Uncle Joel. Services for me had long ago lost any real religious significance, becoming rather a way of renewing my relationship with my Jewish heritage. This may sound strange considering the significance of those days to us Jews, but each must find their own meaning. The prayer book gives us this insight. Birth is a beginning, and death a destination, and life is a journey, a sacred pilgrimage to life everlasting. We shall probably not be remembered for what we have said, but we may be remembered for what we have done. And if we are remembered, then that, I suppose, is the meaning of life everlasting. How do we measure a life? One is by the choices we make, the people whose lives we touch, the children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews we endow with love and wisdom. I believe Joel will be remembered with love by all those who knew him. We should not celebrate death because that, as my mother, who I suspect had more than just a few things in common with her brother, used to say, is nonsense. But we should celebrate life, and no one ever celebrated life more than Joel. Excuse me. He leaves an impossible to fill hole in all of us, but he would want each of us, in our own way, to focus on the happy memories. Cherish the joy he so obviously found in all of you, and most especially in you, Luke. Please join me in saying one more time to Joel, L'chaim, to life. Life. No one ever lived it more fully, embraced it more completely, cherished it more absolutely every day of his life to the very end. He is with us here now. This club was a very special place to him. In fact, among his papers, which you can see in the book outside, I found the letter congratulating him on his membership. He loved this place because it so epitomized his love of food and drink and good cheer. And I suspect, for a reason which was one of his least endearing traits, only he could pick up the check. Yes, I know, many of you are smiling in agreement. Rare and treasured were the times when I got to it first. He always feigned anchor, faker. But Joel will be happy to know that today, in this place, in his place, together with so many of his family and friends, one last time, he got the check. Thanks, Unc. Joel had many passions. food and drink and travel, of course, and music, and also photography. Early on, he was behind the camera, whether a Hasselblad or a Rolleiflex or a Minox. In recent years, as you will see in our portfolio with some highlights of his life, he was more often in front of the camera, joyously posed with his most beloved co-star, Luke. 25 years ago, on another special occasion, my dear friend Judy Gottfried, who shared Joel's love of music and photography, captured what our family believes may be one of his most special and revealing moments. Until recently, I thought I had the only copy. In fact, other cousins also had it, and they thought it was uniquely theirs. Meg decided to use it on the invitation, which you received. Today is a celebration of his life. We think this picture captures his celebration of that life. Every photographer has one special moment, one special picture. As we celebrate this day, please join me in welcoming Judith Gottfried, who I thank for being there at that special moment and for making this one even more so with her special picture. Judy, would you like to come say a few words? Thank you.
I actually knew Joel before I ever met him. I had a vivid memory of the Chef Boyardee ravioli commercial and that voice. I can still hear him saying, "Sour cheeses," or something like that. But who else would have played with the language that way? And it was so amazing to meet the man behind the voice. It was great. So experiences with Joel, some of the same ones Howard and Charles Osgood mentioned, flying with him once. We banked around the Statue of Liberty, and I'm only glad I didn't know that he was going to do that, because I thought I was going to die. It was a great moment. I've never forgotten it. Then there was the time we spent the weekend out in the Hamptons with him, and we went to dinner and to hear a singer, Chris Barrett. Great evening, and afterwards, Joel bought an album of Chris's. In fact, he bought two. And he gave one to me. I still have it. It was a total surprise and just a very small example of Joel's generosity and his ability to delight someone. We had a lot of good times, not only in New York, but also when we would meet up on vacations in Europe. And it was at one of those times that the picture was taken. It was at Waterside, a restaurant outside of London, and it was a perfect day. There was light streaming in the window from the left. We were at the table, and I was in the right place at the right time to take that picture of Joel. I took other pictures that day, but none of them captured the feeling we all had the way the expression on Joel's face does. Relaxed, happy, content, enjoying life. And I think that's the essence of Joel, his ability to enjoy life and bring that same enjoyment to others. I'm glad I was in the right place at the right time for the picture, and I'm very glad I knew him. And to echo Howard, l'chaim. Thank you.
Kind of a dangerous flower vase here. So Bob Gibson's gonna come up next, but I just wanted to thank Bob for all he did. He wrote beautiful tributes about my dad, and when I was still kind of reeling and trying to comprehend what happened, Bob had already put together a beautiful tribute and got it out on 5 different websites and put it in different newspapers and newsletters and put together a wonderful compilation of my dad's work. And Bob's been amazing, and I have been a little bit in a stupor, so haven't been particularly responsive, but are deeply grateful for all that you've done. Thank you so much.
You're Good afternoon. Pardon the cold. At the risk of being redundant, my name is Bob Gibson. Joel Krager was not only a top-flight air talent, but a wonderful man. Going to lunch or dinner, and probably breakfast, although I don't recall ever having breakfast with him, was always a good time. It was a given. The stories are countless, and there's still one that sticks in my head. It goes back about 13 or 14 years when I invited him for the first time to attend the twice-a-year broadcasters' luncheons that I was hosting at the time. I had said something to Joel like, come join us. You'll have a wonderful time. You can tell people about your E.F. Hutton commercials and your adventures with other accounts. And he said, I can't do that. And I turned and I looked at him and said, why? The response I received was completely unexpected. He said very simply, I'm shy. And yes, when he said this to me, because I think those of us that have known him a while knew when he was serious and when he wasn't, he was dead serious. So I said, well, how about if I tell these other people about you? And to that he said, oh, that's fine. So here's a man who was, during his ABC years, on the air dozens of times a week, and he was shy. But if he knew you, there was precious little that was out of bounds. I still recall that Joel and his old pal and colleague, Dirk Fredericks, were on the air together doing a sustaining midday music show on the ABC radio network when shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in Dallas. And to the best of my knowledge, the two of them were off the air for the rest of the day because of the continuing news coverage. Joel loved his work. He loved his family. At the risk of repeating what you've already heard, he loved life. I always felt when I was with him, if he could, he'd wrap his arms around life. And when he wasn't working, he was more often than not flying his plane. He loved to travel, even if someone else were at the controls. Case in point. One year, he and his love, Pat, went on a cruise to Alaska, where one of the ports of call was Sitka. Just before arriving in Sitka, Pat had lost a filling, and after much telephoning, Pat managed to find a lady dentist who gave her a same-day appointment. This woman, operating in her home, did a great job on replacing Pat's filling. However, there's another story here. The other story here is about Joel. He'd been waiting for her in the living room. And when the people found out about Joel's professional background, they took him down to the town's radio station. They wanted him to record a station break. Now, the way the story goes, before that could happen, somebody asked Pat if that would be okay. And she said she figured the only concern Joel might have would be union restrictions. But the response was, union? What union? This is Alaska. So for years after that, Joel was teased by Pat about being the voice of KCAW Sitka, Alaska. And as far as Pat knows, shake your head, Pat, he probably still is. My personal thought was, who else could get work that effortlessly while in the midst of an Alaskan cruise? Besides the KCAW gig, there were plenty of others back home in New York. And for the next 4 minutes, you'll get to see a montage of just a sliver of Joel Krager's professional life. And it opens with a very familiar face.
Kenneth Feinberg has a most unusual job and a most unusual title to go with it. Special Master is what he's called. Richard Schlesinger is about to show us why.
Well, my broker is E.F. Hutton. And E.F. Hutton says,
when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen.
To paraphrase the ad from a now extinct financial firm,
let me say, in order to get out from under my jurisdiction,
when Ken Feinberg speaks, Wall Street listens.
Welcome to Youth Must Be Heard, an unrehearsed public affairs program. Election Day is just 24 hours away. And so tonight, our youthful panel will question the rival candidates in one of the city's key congressional elections. Let's meet those candidates. First, Professor Clark Williams. And at the other side of the table, his opponent, Mr. T.J. Blodgett. Now let's meet our young panelists, all from local high schools. John Maynard, Albert Kramer, and two pretty cousins from Brooklyn Heights, Patty Lane and Kathy Lane.
See, the girls look so poised, don't they?
There she is. Hi.
With 80% of the returns in from the district, here are the tallies. Clark Williams, 75,844. T.J. Blodgett, 18,300. Well, it's a landslide for Williams.
It's at the bottom of my elbow. It's throbbing. The more you twist, the more the pain hurts. When I get a pain like that, I will take aspirin.
Today, Richard Mazzancini is trying extra-strength Tylenol gel caps. For pain like his, why take aspirin or ibuprofen when nothing works better than Tylenol gel caps?
The pain is gone. It's great. I feel good. No pain. It doesn't hurt. It feels fluid. I'm convinced I'm going to be a gel cap user.
Extra-strength gel caps, only from Tylenol. For everyday pain, nothing works better.
You never run out of things to do until you want to.
4 days and three nights in the Bahamas, only $199, including airfare.
Please to put on some speed, follow my lead. Oh, how I need.
For all the little ones we've helped bring in this world, a gentle reminder, no one watches over you like us. U.S. Healthcare, a health plan for living.
Terrible cold. It's just awful. Oh, the itchy eyes, the ruddy nose, the head.
Today we'd like you to try Tylenol Cold.
I didn't know that Tylenol came in a cold formula.
Tylenol Cold has four powerful medicines to help relieve runny nose, congestion, hacking cough, and aching pain.
I feel wonderful. I feel so much better. I could trust Tylenol to get rid of my headache, and now I can trust Tylenol Cold to get rid of all my cold symptoms.
Tylenol Cold. Trust it because it's Tylenol. Use it because it works. Also a no drowsiness.
England's famous 17-year-old model enjoys a tour of Hollywood, including a visit with Sonny and Cher. See Twiggy in Hollywood, a color special.
Thursday at 9:30, 8:30 Central Time on ABC.
It may have seemed longer, but that was 4 minutes, in my estimation, of truth and beauty with Joel Krager. The only other thing I want to say is, A colleague of his, who I'd known a long time, who was unable to attend today, said a long time ago what I always felt, but I think he said it more succinctly than I. When Joel would read copy at auditions or at the booking, he digested it, he was ready to go, he had a picture with, I guess, a little bit of feedback from the client, producers, techs, what have you, of what they wanted. And most of the time, I wasn't there, so I can't tell you it was one take or 12 takes, and it's immaterial. How it came out is what counts. But this colleague, namely Bill Owen, said, in his estimation, and I agree, Joel had this way of interpreting commercial copy and making it, if you will, sing the way he felt it should have. So God bless you, Joel. I miss you. I've missed you since July 28th, and I will continue to do so. And thank you all very much for your time.
For putting that together as a wonderful tribute. And our next person to talk is Pat, who, as you all know, is my dad's beloved life companion for 20-something years. So, Pat.
Well, I should have asked Charlie or Dick or Bob about mic technique, because I've never been on microphone before. I don't even know if this is this good. Everybody can hear okay? I had all these remarks prepared that started off with, well, after 23 or so years, you get to know a fella pretty well. And it went from there. Bob took one of my best stories about the Sitka. Yes, and told it beautifully, just beautifully. We really laughed about that a lot. With all of his other wonderful, well-known spots, this little station break for K-Cola just made us so happy. I thought long and hard about what story should I tell. Should I tell the Sitka story? Should I tell about the cross-country airplane trip that we took together? That's already been mentioned. So has the Alaska story. But there was a time in Nantucket when we flew there for New Year's Eve. We had dinner in a little ship captain's home, very intimate, candlelit, beautiful. There was one other couple there, a man and a woman. We started chatting. And he said how he was a retired advertising man and asked what Joel did. Joel said, I'm a voiceover announcer. And the man took a beat and he said, ooh, do you happen to know Joel Krager? What a true story. And so I guess with that, I'm going to spare you his favorite puns. How about that? You know, those of you who know Joel know he was a big punster, and he loved that. But I'm going to spare you that. I'm just going to say thank you for all of the good times, all of the good friends, all of the good memories, my extended family, and thank you for coming. Here's to Joel.
My cousin Bert, who my dad loved to go out for wonderful meals with and have wonderful times with. So, come on.
I have no prepared remarks, but I did want to say a couple things about Joel, whom I knew for 75 years. You want to think about that. Joel and I grew up together. Joel was 6 years older than I. He was my mother's youngest brother. And it's unimaginable that there's a world without him, but we will try. I want to just share two bits about radio, and Charles got it 110% right. When I was 6 years old and Joel was 12, Joel was already planning to be a radio announcer. His voice was changing, and he was planning to be a radio announcer. And I remember one day when my parents and I were visiting with Joel and his parents, and also present was Jim's father, Bob, who was then playing with Johnny Pineapple and his Royal Hawaiians at the Hawaiian Room of the Hotel Lexington. And Joel and I were listening to the radio, as we always did. And on the radio on this Sunday, December 7th, 1941, there was an announcement about Pearl Harbor. We didn't actually know what that was, and we went downstairs to tell everybody, and all the Hawaiians knew about Pearl Harbor. That's a little interesting anecdote from the old days. One other anecdote. When I was fighting valiantly for the United States Army in Indianapolis, Indiana, I was a victim of the Asian flu before they knew what that was, and I was lying in my hospital bed feeling sorry for myself, and Joel came on the ABC News to tell me about the death of Sibelius and played Finlandia for me. Well, I know he played it for other people, but I thought he was doing it for me, and I was very touched by that. And I will never forget his voice and how delicious he was and how he smelled and how we shared good food and wine together in France, where I live, as you know. And we all miss him, but he'll be with us forever.
Thank you, Bert. Oh, Dick Shepherd, my dad's great friend. I've had the honor of getting to know Dick after my dad's death. He's very kindly called me up and shared some very moving, wonderful stories. Thank you.
And I didn't lie.
Let me tell you about my friend, Joel Craker. Early on, we kind of knew each other in the business, and we respected each other. We weren't friends. I really don't know how we became friends. I think we started talking flying one day at ABC. I used to love to embarrass him. Every now and then, everybody did that. Every now and then, they would send a staff announcer up to do a station break or a system cue. Why, I don't know, because I wasn't on the network. It was local. So they would send Milton Cross up, and I would say, no, Milton Cross can't do a station break on my show. But this man is, you know, and Milton would get all embarrassed. And then Joel came up one day, and all big voice stood there looking at me, and I said, no way. No way I'm going to have this man do a break and show my voice. That rat loved it. Made me do it 2 or 3 more times. So that was our deal. We got meeting that way. But everybody's talked about Joel in many different ways. Let me tell you when, first of all, Pat referred to the fact that Joel always wanted to pick up a tab, and everyone else says that. We were two idiots of the same kind. We would go in and have a coffee or a lunch or whatever, and we'd both fight over it. And one day, a voice from an extremely clever mind came out, and Pat said, why don't you guys just split it? We never thought of that. Our egos wouldn't allow it. So we did. Of course, he wanted the bigger half. I let him have the penny. But let me tell you the things that we did that really I'll never forget. Joel and I would have a lot of fun flying. We would fly anywhere for what used to be called the $2 hamburger, and as Charlie over there knows, is now more like the $50 hamburger. We would fly everywhere in separate planes. We had the same plane. He had a slightly bigger engine, a little bit faster, which he never let me forget. And we'd go to Cape Cod, have lunch, come back. One day he had a great idea. He said, listen, let's go to Montreal. I said, are you out of your head? He said, what, it's 2,330 air miles. I said, yeah, but do you know what customs would do at either end? Two idiots coming up there, no one else in the plane, they'd rip everything apart. He said, yeah, not a good idea. So we went to Cape Cod. But one day, Pat and Joel were down in Virginia, and he had a little difficulty with his plane, the starter or something, so they rented a car and came back. He hated to drive when he could fly. And he called me one day and he said, listen, I'll pay for the gas if you'll fly me down to Virginia. I said, don't worry about the gas, I'll fly you down. I flew him down there and he said, let me pay for the gas. I said, no, I'll tell you what, let me earn the gas. We'll have a bet. He said, what do you have in mind? I said, well, your plane's a little faster than mine, so you gotta give me a few minutes head start, 12 or 15 minutes, and first one back to Teterboro wins. If I win, I get the gas. If I lose, even. He said, deal. I cheated. See, there's a little spot over there, it may have been Quantico, which is airspace reserved for the Marine Corps, but it's not always busy. Now, he had to go around that, you see, and I did on the way down, but it was late in the afternoon, about 5:30, 6 o'clock. I figured, maybe they're not busy. So I called down and said, are you hot? And they said, no, no. I said, can I transit? They said, sure. So I got up there, kissed the plane, put it to bed, and I'm waiting for Joel, listening to my little radio, and I hear him call in for a landing. And when he comes in, I'm sitting in the lounge with a newspaper, a cup of coffee. He said, how long you been here? I said, about an hour and a half. He said, oh, come on. It was about a half hour. But he had to go around. He was so pissed. I mean, really. And he said, how did you do it? I said, About 6 months later, he said, you dirty dog, I figured it out. I think he asked Charlie. I mean, Charlie may have told him. But Charlie is the guy, by the way, Captain Charles, who tried very hard to teach both Joel and this one a little tiny bit of professionalism. He never succeeded, but he gave him bowls of chili and made him very happy. We did a lot of interesting things which really amounted to nothing. I think our favorite time, both of us, was to go down to a boat basin at the Hudson River, and we'd sit there with a cigar each and a cup of coffee, potato or coffee, and maybe a hamburger. And we just sit there and watch the flotsam and the jetsam go by, and we'd watch the tide change and come back. And that was the best time we had together. We talked about everything, anything, and a lot of times nothing. Joel, I really miss you.
Annette Cunningham, dear friend of our families and my dad's.
Those of you who are in, have been, Joel has graced your business. Don't search around trying to think of why you should know me. There's no reason, except the most important one, which is that I was a friend of Joel Krager, and always will be. I thought of a memory today that has to do with Joel, at flying with Joel, my maiden voyage. And it's a sweet story. So I thought, well, here I am in the Cathedral of the Roast. I can't really just be completely kind here. So I have to say that even in the worst weather conditions and the worst possible flying conditions, it probably wasn't as frightening to be in a plane with Joel as it was to be in an automobile. When the traffic was bad and the drivers weren't as professional as he. Now back to flying. I was in Northern Connecticut with a friend of Joel's And here's where I lucked out. I came along for the ride, and what a ride it's been. Joel said, "How'd you like to have lunch in Nantucket?" Seemed completely exotic to me. Grew up in Manhattan, Illinois, 427 people. Never been in a private plane before. Well, off we went to the airport, got into the plane. I was in the back of two seats. My friend was in the front with Joel, and we got above the gently coloring leaves of Connecticut fall. And Joel said, "Oh, damn, your door's not closed tightly." Now remember, I'd never been in anything but a commercial jet, pressurized. So, of course, my life began to pass before my eyes. And I thought, it's just a matter of seconds till we're all sucked out of this plane and spread across the Connecticut landscape. Now, it seemed like about 15 years that this situation went on, while Joel said, no, that didn't do it, swing it wider. Life goes on. You know, I'm now to about age 10. Finally, he said, "Well, put the window down a little and we'll see if we can." I thought, finally it dawned. The three people who knew about flying weren't terrified. That should have said something. But it was much more than that, now that I think of it. What it was about was that Joel was in charge. And I knew that nothing bad would happen when Joel was in charge. Because there was there an honesty and an honorableness and a professionalism, an ultimate professionalism. And Joel's at the controls. It's okay. So I think we've all shared that experience at one level or another. And I celebrate that. And I celebrate him. The last time that I had a substantive conversation with him, I was really having a very tough time because I was trying to interview him for a story that would be called The Voice of Authority. Good? Try to get Joel to talk about A, himself, and B, in a complimentary fashion. Tough work. But we had fun, and it was in this building, so it's full circle. Now, I think life is way, way too short and too precious for any regrets. But if I had a regret, it would be, as I told Meg today, that I didn't bully him into someday treating me to a reading of Robert Bolt's beautiful script from Man for All Seasons, in which Thomas More rhapsodizes about his daughter Meg. It would have taken on new meaning. I'll go back as Joel's nephew did to my faith and say, I'll end with a compliment, which is, God, what a fine creation. Thank you.
Unit. That was beautiful. So I'd just like to open it up now to anybody who'd like to just come and say a few words. And this is my mom, Ishani Frankel. I'm so delighted that she came today.
Well, this is going to be totally ad-lib because Meg didn't say anything to me about the fact that I would be speaking today. I was Joel's first wife. We got married when I was 18 and he was 19. And my mother thought that I was an old maid because I wasn't married by the time I was 18. But that was a different time. I learned to fly with Joel. We took lessons together. We had the same teacher, a woman who inspired me, and I thought, well, gee, maybe I can get my instrument rating and go on and get my jet rating and eventually be a pilot for an airline. Why not? But I was busy with the kids at the time, and I really didn't have that much time to spend on flying, although I put in about 800 hours. Many things that I remember about Joel that are, he had great beauty and great inner strength and a love for life that each person who's spoken has spoken about. I'm very happy that I'm sitting next to Pat, because I had 23 years of marriage with him, and she had the last 23 years of life with him. That was a great joy from what she says. And I'm so glad. It's inspired me to see many old acquaintances and relatives that I haven't seen for many years. And I'm really grateful that I came, and I can feel that Joel is here, right here next to me. Happy that you're here too. Thank you.
Anybody like to come and say a few words? Anyone else? No, you all have lots of good stories to tell, so please come up and share if you'd like to. Just come on, please.
I'm Jeff Berman. I met Joel in 1967 when I was production director and community services director at WABC. Joel was one of 28 staff announcers I had access to do public service announcements for me. And I have to say that I was lucky that I got him for free. I could just pick up a phone to network and say, I want Joel. And some of the work he did for me, of course, most of it was of a fundraising or inspirational or public service nature. So it brought out all the qualities that were inherent in Joel in terms of warmth and caring and humanity. And I remember at one point I expressed some frustration at the amount of creative work I was able to do in that job. And Joel took me aside and said, use it before it dries up. In other words, you have other gifts, get out and use them. If you really feel that fire in the belly, and it's being stopped, change it now. And that was Joel. And toward the end of his life, we were both signed with the same agency as voiceover people. And I hired Joel as an announcer through the years, sporadically. But I think that I was lucky in that for a while I lived in New Jersey, in Edgewater. And Joel and I would ride the boat from Weehawken every morning. Not every morning, every few mornings. And it was very, anyone looking in probably thought there was something strange going on, because here were these two rather sophisticated looking guys on the boat, talking quietly to each other. Little did they know we were telling old man Jewish jokes in dialect. And the thing that really carried me through the years. After New Jersey, we didn't see too much of each other. He would come in and audition for me sporadically when I had my audio production company in New York. But every time I saw Joel, whether it was on an audition or coming into my studios, the feeling I always got was one of, for want of a better word, I'll use two words, warmth and groundedness. He gave me a sense of history, knowing how long I'd known him. I remember the advice he gave me. I remember the level of his warmth and professionalism. And it always put me in a peaceful place, a quiet, warm, strong place. He radiated that and gave it to me and to everyone in this room. And I want to say thank you, Joel.
Anyone else want to come and say a few words, please?
Hi, I'm Sybil Weinberger-Costello, and I've known Joel since I was 11 years old. I used to babysit for Meg and Kathy and Terry. I haven't seen you in a long time. It's nice to see you. Anyway, I just have a very personal story with Joel. When I was 17, I was working up in Maine in a summer camp, and I got a call from my mother saying my father had had a heart attack and was in the hospital and come home. And so I took the train home, and when I got to Grand Central Station, I called home, and somebody answered the phone, and they said, well, your father has died, and just stay there, because Joel and Binny and Mort Munchen were all going to come pick you up. And so I sat there, and I was crying in the phone booth, and all of a sudden, I saw these three guys coming, and Binny and Mort Munchen were looking very solemn, and what are we going to do? And Joel just came up, opened his arms, took me in his arms, said, it's all going to be okay, and they took me home. And then it was okay. I mean, it was tough. Anyway, fade out, come back 10 years later. I was working in New York at ABC, and who was the first person I saw? But Joel Krager, and then we became friends on an adult level. Anyway, Joel, we will miss you. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bill Deal, and I work at ABC, but I first met Joel in the early 70s. I came from WNEW, where I was working with this guy over here, Dick Shepard, on the Milkman's Matinee. At WNEW, we could do our own thing. We didn't need announcers, but when I came to ABC, they said, we have certain programs and we have to have a staff announcer introduce you. I said, oh, all right, that's pretty fancy stuff. We had a program called Meet the Author, and we would have major authors come in. So I was about ready to do my program, and all of a sudden the studio door opened and this man came in and he introduced himself. He said, I'm Joel Krager. He says, I'm your announcer. Well, I sat down and we did a little quick run through, and then he said, are you ready? I said, I think so. In my soprano voice by then, after listening to Joel Krager, you know. So here he is, you know, saying, meet the author. Now here is ABC News correspondent Bill Deal. I mean, I felt like I was a little mouse, you know. I said, wait till my mother hears this, you know, being introduced by Joel Krager. But I tell you, he was such a special guy. We didn't get to know each other an awful lot during those years. Later, I got to know him again through the board meeting. Bob Gibson invited me to come over. And it was always a joy to talk to him and sit with him. I always wanted to be an announcer early on in my career. Never made it. I was always hoping to, you know, say, the following program is brought to you in living color on NBC or something like that. But I never got to do that. But Joel did it all. And I found out in later years about his flying expertise. Amazing. What a guy, what a life he led, and it's so wonderful to celebrate a life. So often, you know, we mourn people when they have passed, and everybody is, you know, in tears. Yeah, there are tears early on, but later, when we have an event like this, there's nothing like it. So special, so nice to have loving people, and we all love this guy a lot. Thanks an awful lot, Joel, for being part of my life and your lives.
Good afternoon. My name is Bruce Brown, a colleague of Joel's for many, many years, and I am the Shepherd Emeritus of the Lambs Club. And on behalf of all of my flock, we wish to extend our sincere condolences to Joel's family his friends, and our brother friars. Many years ago, you had a member here at the Friars. His name was Ed Herlihy. And Eddie and I were making our way to a studio one fine day to do some job, I forget now what it was. And the engineer came out from behind the board and he said, is Krager out of sight yet? And he said, yes. So we said, see you, Joel. He said, last Saturday, I took a ride in Joel Krager's airplane. And he said it was the damnedest experience I ever had. Jimmy, being no flyer, said they left a small airport over here on the Hudson, flew up the river, and Joel said, we're going under the bridge. Jimmy said, Jesus. And indeed, they flew under the George Washington Bridge. On the way back, Joel said, let's do it again. Jim begged him all the way down the river not to do it. And he didn't. He said he was never so frightened in his entire life. Once again, on behalf of all of my flock at the Lambs, we wish to give your family, your friends, neighbors, and colleagues our best regards, and once again, our sincere condolences on Joel's passing. Thanks very much.
My name is Dwight Tobin, and I'm the Dwight, I guess, apologize to Mr. Lee and Mr. Shepherd that Joel kept putting you on hold while we were on the phone together. Joel gave me probably the best advice I ever had, which was, get out of the business, kid. I need to explain that. I met Joel about 35 years ago, and what I mean by get out of the business, I was working on the wrong side of the fence. I was an ad agency producer. Well, I kept getting fired, and I guess I grew up working for the Shakespeare Festival and building sets, hanging lights, always behind the scenes since I was about, I guess, 10 years old. Well, the only way I could earn a living, I wound up the ad agencies. And I worked with Joel a couple of times, and he said, what are you doing here? I said, what do you mean? He said, you're a misfit. And I guess that was the beginning of it, because I was a young kid, I was an assistant producer, scared out of my mind, not knowing what to do. Joel said, don't worry about it. And I had a script to do. We were working on TWA. And I just handed Joel the script. And he said, what do you want? What's the direction? And I said to him, well, Joel, you're an actor. He said, yes. And I said, act. I walked away. And we were friends from that point forward. He clued me in, a lot of things in the business. And I finally, I guess when I was fired for the third time, I went out, I guess, I'm sorry, I guess three isn't very much to be fired. But Joel and I remained friends for 25 years after that. We worked together once or twice. Some corporate industrial work. We flew together once or twice. And then he let me in on his nickname, which was Mumbles. And I said, you're kidding. And then I understood that, because I thought I was going deaf, but when I was on the phone with Joel, what? Hello? Joel, say again? What? And couldn't understand a word he said. But in all my years, I never met someone as self-deprecating, as modest, and as giving as Joel. Again, he always picked up the check, no matter what we did. And I think the funniest story, which many in this room will understand, is when Joel and I did work together professionally. He looked at the script, looked at his watch, 28 and a half seconds. Well, that was in the film days, sorry, but he read it. Joel, you're a second long. Yeah, no problem. He read it. Where do you want to have lunch? Well, I think the funniest story, to be very brief, was one of my last jobs with Joel, again, about 25 years ago. We were doing a 30-second commercial. We were on the 47th take. Now, we were working, tempers were short. Not between Joel and myself, but we had an art director who was a parody, pardon me, a parody of an announcer. Joel, I want you to read it like this. So I stepped in, we made sure the mic was closed. I stepped into the booth, and I had my back to the glass. Switch on. Joel's in front of me now. Joel, get me out of this. What do I do? And he said, I'll do it. I'm going to kill this guy, and then we're going to have lunch. He probably did the worst take of his entire life. I have it somewhere. And he said, let's get out of here. We're going to lunch. Get out of the business. And that was it. So ever since then, Joel has been a dear friend, a colleague, a mentor. There are no words to express what Joel has done. I'm sure we all feel this way. How does one define friendship? I don't know. It's a feeling. It's something that two people develop and that we share together. I won't try to put it in words. I'm sure we all know the feeling. And all I can say is, Joel, thank you. We love you. You will be missed dearly. And the one thing I always like to mention at times like this is a quotation I once saw on a headstone. I'm not sure where it's from, but it's always brought me comfort, and I hope it does the same for everyone here. It says, to live in the hearts of those we leave behind is not to die. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Jerry Topio. I'm a cousin of Joel. More so, I'm what I consider to be a very, very good friend, particularly in the last 10 or 15 years. Joel, we go back a long way. I'm looking, Terry, I haven't seen you in 55 years since we used to go up and visit Jimmy in Pleasantville. Joel was just such a unique and wonderful guy. It was a pleasure in the last 10 or 15 years to have lunch probably once a month, once every 2 months. And it's interesting that Dwight mentioned that Joel was nicknamed Mumbles, because I thought that was just a tribute to my hearing. But I had difficulty, and one of the favorite places that we would go to for lunch was a Japanese restaurant in Englewood, New Jersey. And we thought it would be nice to sit to Tommy style. And this place, it wasn't true to Tommy because it kind of had a hole in the floor, you could dangle your feet. And I persuaded Joel that we should sit side by side to Tommy. And the reason being that we both then would be able to look out into the restaurant and we wouldn't, one of us wouldn't have to face the wall. But the reality of it was that I could hear him much better that way. And we would do this on a frequent basis. And I have to tell you that the luncheons with Joel was something that I really used to look forward to. And in tribute to Joel, towards the end of this terrible illness that he endured, he still managed to muster the strength to insist that we continue sitting to Tommy. And he forced himself onto the floor, put himself in this position, and managed to extricate himself after luncheon from the same position, which I know could not have been easier, but could not have been easy for him. But he was just such a unique guy, and there are so many stories. I'll bore you with one more, which I thought was unique to us, and in speaking to our friends Richard and Betty, we all lived in the same building together, found out that he had done the same to them as well. We had taken him out to dinner, and I use the words taken him out because this was an unacceptable thing. It was murder getting a check from Joel. But we succeeded in this particular case, and I think the way we did it was we called ahead and gave him a credit card. And he was infuriated. He was absolutely infuriated. But he was waiting, and I think he was going through some marital difficulties at the time, and so we didn't get to go out to dinner, even though we did lunches. We didn't go out to dinner as a foursome for some time after that. And once he calls us and he says, I want you and Rona to come to dinner with us at the Saddle River Inn. And we said, well, it's fine. And he said, and this is BYOB, so I'm bringing the wines. I said, that's fine. He said, I don't want to hear anything about the check. I don't want to hear anything. He laid down the law to me so completely, there was almost no wiggle room that I had. Well, he shows up, and he's certainly known, to say the least, there. And he sits as they bring us upstairs to what appeared to be his table. And he gives this bag of plainly paper bag of wines to the captain. Captain then comes over with a magnificent bottle of champagne shortly after, and then he looks at him and he says, Mr. Krager, shall I open the Lafitte or the Latour first? And I think this is a big joke, and he's kidding. And sure enough, comes some, I don't remember what the vintage year Lafitte was, but I mean, and he opened them both. And he opened them both. And this was characteristic of Joel. He was one of the most kindest, most interesting, just nicest guy. Family member, no family member. He didn't take a lot of people into close contact with him. As a matter of fact, I remember in the buildings when we would see each other in the elevator, he had an iPod on his ears, and this was to keep the people away, I think, to a large degree. And he was listening to a podcast or he was listening to music, but when he saw us, and I think he may have only known 6 or 8 people in our building over the many, many years that he lived there, he would then remove the iPod, and then you knew you were okay with him. Very, very, very special man who I loved a great deal. Rest in peace, Joel.
This is really an honor. I am Miles Krieger. You see, David Krieger was his dad. That's my grandfather, Israel's brother. And I just want to tell you that David Krieger was the most jovial man with the most smiling eyes, and we used to call him Santa Claus. He was this short little jolly guy, and actually, he and Aunt Lil used to take care of Anna, who's back there, and me, and that's my parents, that's Benson Krieger and Natalie. And it is just extraordinary that all of us have about two or three degrees of connection, but everything all goes through Joel. I mean, Bert, I was at your bar mitzvah. Howard, I was at your bar mitzvah. Terry, I remember you sitting there in our living room, in our dining room, with a bowl of lettuce. I've never seen anyone but a rabbit eat. Meg, I remember you and Kathy ice skating on our frozen swimming pool. You were 7 years old. And to think that all of us were connected is really quite extraordinary. Jimmy, I must say, I know about you because of Joel. Bert, I know about you, him having meals with you in France, and he was very excited because as soon as Regine came into the family, we married in Paris. I mean, Joel was definitely at that wedding in Paris, you know. He loved Regine. And yes, we too flew to Nantucket for lunch. And yes, we too had the battles over the check. But I just want to add one thing that you didn't know about the battles over the check, and Dad pretty much coined it. You see, Dad also would try to figure out how to trump Joel. And I just remember it was the greatest joy when we would succeed. And Dad's favorite expression is, if you want to see a nuclear explosion and you want to see sparks and fire and smoke come out of his ears, you know his face would become red. And he was Joel. And all of us have loved Joel. And he loved these two women. I remember when you were a little girl, you were 17 when I first met you. And I know how much he loved you, Pat, too, and how much time we spent together, how Eric spent a summer in your apartment, and how we've done so many things together. And, well, it's just amazing that all of us have this moment, which will probably never exist again, but we have this moment where this superhuman being has been at the center of us all having met each other and having had this experience of Joel Krieger. Thank you.
Anybody else like to say a few words? Well, Pat asked me to pass on the fact that Freddie Roman, who is the head of the Fires Club, had wanted to be here, was not able to make it, and sends his regrets. I just want to thank you all for coming and sharing this wonderful celebration of my father. It's so just the first time that I felt joy since he died. So thank you so much. Let's all take our joyful memories of our times with him with us. May he live in our hearts for the rest of our lives. Thank you for coming. And please, let's just celebrate together and have some informal conversation, something else to drink. And thank you so much.